As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
This is Talk of the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United. We're recording shortly after 11 p.m. on Monday night after Manchester United's heaviest defeat of the Premier League season, 4-0 against Crystal Palace. It's a result that has led to many, many questions, some of which we'll try to answer, of course, on this podcast. What went wrong again and what exactly does it mean for the manager, Erik ten Hag's future? I need to introduce you to a bumper lineup for this podcast. Even Laurie Whitwell is back to debate exactly what's going on. Carl Anker is still at Selhurst Park, so we may lose Carl at some point when he gets chucked out. He's also in the press working area still, so there'll be people in the background there, and Andy Mitter's joining us from home as well. Laurie, I'll start with you. Welcome back. Why exactly did you want to do this?
Well, I feel like it was such a seismic result that I should try and offer my own thoughts and try and anchor this in some kind of notion of what it all means. And also just I wanted to celebrate the fact that I didn't have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to watch that, because I'm now back from Vietnam. I think I would have been even more despondent watching that in the middle of the night had I been. But yeah, so you know, I'm quite wide-eyed now. You know, this is early hours for me, so I feel like I've got stuff to say.
Well, we'll certainly get into all of that. Carl, you're still there. I mean, before we talk about Ten Hag, just how bad was tonight? You know, I think Laurie tweeted he thought it was one of the worst performances post Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United. Did you think it was that bad?
Yeah, that was abject. That's up there with Everton 4-0. That's up there with Brighton 4-0, Brentford 4-0. The Liverpool 7-0 on the Ten Hag is a bit different because Liverpool are meant to be one of the better teams in the world, but in terms of you've been given an absolute pasting just from a team being competent and dedicated to running. Ugh.
Yeah, it's awful. I'm not absolutely stunned that Manchester United lost the game easily. I'm sad to say. I felt pretty ominous all day before the match, and unfortunately this is happening with increasing frequency, and not just against the top teams, against mid-table teams, and that's been borne out in the results as well. So when I saw that Maguire was injured and then Bruno Fernandes, my mood just slumped even more. And when Palace went ahead after what, 12 minutes, I just thought, this is going to be a stinking night.
Yeah, we'll get into the aspects of the game in a moment, but I think the biggest discussion after that result and the nature of the performance as well will be about the future of Erik ten Hag. Andy, what are you feeling about it? What do you think this result means for him?
Completely conflicted. I can't compare it to any previous managers. People say, is this like when Jose or Van Gaal or Moyes? I feel confused, conflicted. I think the players do. I think the coaching staff do. The only person who seems to talk with any conviction is Erik ten Hag, and you sort of nod along because you want to believe in him, and then you watch his teams play and you just think, what on earth's going on here? So there's going to be a lot of conjecture about whether he goes or not, and I see people going like, that's got to be the end, But that's just an opinion. What's the fact? I've not had any evidence that he's about to lose his job. I just haven't. And I'm sure we're going to talk about this. I'm sure he's hurting like we all are. I'm sure his popularity ratings slump with every awful performance and result. But it's I just don't think it's that clear cut.
All along, and I've written a piece before I went away, that the ideal for Ineos was to keep him on, and he was involved in planning for pre-season, next season. But a result like that and a performance like that, more importantly, really tests that notion. And I'm not even saying that Ineos wanted to keep him because they feel like he's absolutely the best man for the job, but it's, you know, kind of the card that has been dealt. And to change him, as well as having changed the kind of structure, is just another sort of element to the uncertainty. So ideally, you know, you'd keep him in place. But that result performance brings up questions of whether something is broken there between manager and players. Now, obviously, there's massive mitigation, I think, with the injury list. But that in itself is something to discuss, because it reminded me a little bit of that Palace game two seasons ago when Ralf Rangnick was manager and you had a load of players injured. You know, if you really wanted to play, it was that kind of question. You know, if you really wanted to play 2 years ago, you know, could you have played through whatever illness you've got, any ailment you've got? And I'm not saying that's necessarily the case now, but it just feels strange that you've got so many injuries at this time of the season. And clearly then, you know, Ten Hag playing with a difficult team. You know, you've got Casemiro at centre-back. We'll get onto that, I think, in more detail. Another changed defensive lineup. So you clearly, there's some kind of chaos going on in the game. That being said, you know, a lot of the players out there on the pitch are, you know, genuine first teamers in their position. So is that something to do with the coaching, where you're seeing these problems persistently happen? Is that something to do with the players that just aren't able to, you know, carry out the instructions, or that seem like they don't really have the impetus to carry out the instructions? They're kind of doing their own thing a lot of the time.
In his press conference, Ten Hag said United players didn't follow the script. Now, this is something, you know, one of Ten Hag's more common things after the disappointing thing result is he says the players didn't stick to the plan. They didn't stick to the plan, or they didn't follow the rules. And he says, when you don't follow the rules, you then have to follow the facts. And the facts are, the other team are better than you when you start making silly mistakes, either on an individual basis or in a team-wide shape. This press conference, it's odd because Ten Hag very clearly cited some individual mistakes, but also didn't. He would cite an individual mistake, but then also say, it's not about the individual, it's about the team response to the individual mistake. And he said that was also disappointing. There is just a huge gap between the football Ten Hag wants to do and the football Manchester United are currently capable of. There was probably a point earlier on in the season where Ten Hag might have had an opportunity to change and adapt his plan, and you know, we often talk about pragmatism and make something simpler. However, I think Ten Hag at those junctures earlier on in the season decided, well, if I don't keep trying to teach this team how to play my way, there will never be the correct opportunity for them to learn it. So I'm just going to double down. And what you've got now is a situation where the players that perhaps were the most capable of carrying out this football are either injured or horribly underperforming because someone else in another key area is injured. And then what's left are the remaining players who cannot do it. And the it is for a number of different reasons. The it can be physical capacity to play football, or the it could be technical ability on the ball, or the it could be off the ball application. And the fact that there are so many different its is why it's so hard for Ten Hag to sort it. And also, as Andy said, the way Ten Hag goes about discussing things, he cuts an increasingly beleaguered, if not unconvincing, figure to everyone, and it's really uncomfortable right now.
It is, and it's the confidence of the players as well. It looks like the confidence in themselves, in the way that the team's playing and set up to play, they're losing confidence in it. I mean, you look at the performance tonight of multiple players. You know, you say he doesn't want to single out individuals. Even that first goal, you know, automatically you point the finger at Casemiro for diving in. But then I watched the analysis on Sky with Jamie Carragher, on the Premier League's international output as well, with Paul Scholes, both of them pointing at Christian Eriksen, saying, why is he so far up from the throw-in? He's on the wrong side of the referee. If you watch the clip back, you'll understand what I mean. Then criticising the way that Kobbie Mainoo reacts to it, criticising the way that Johnny Evans reacts to it. I mean, it was revealing, really, quite how many players they believed could have done something different in that moment. That is a collective failing. That's not just Casemiro diving in. I mean, Andy, we've heard this from Ten Hag before, but we've also made this argument before. Fair enough, the players aren't following your rules, but isn't it on you to make those players follow your rules?
I remember vividly discussing before Fulham away the point of players not following the manager's instructions.
Yeah.
And they actually won that game, which is rare because United don't win in London under Ten Hag. The record in the capital is absolutely appalling. Somehow that away end was sold out tonight. If we're going to give any positives, I think that away following...
They're amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We're sat here doing this now. We're going to get our heads down. They've got 5-hour coach journeys back. To be fair, the club contributed to the coach journey. Sellers Park is not an easy ground to reach from Manchester, but I was at that game that has been mentioned 2 years ago when Ten Hag was there, and it felt like the end of the world in some respects and that a brighter future was going to come. And it was really flat even in the stands that night. It wasn't tonight. The players are on the floor. The confidence is on the floor. They're struggling. It's a completely fractured squad assembled by several different managers. Players are playing out of position. There's massive uncertainty. Members of the staff do not know whether they're going to have a job in a month or two's time. And that's not just Eric Ten Hag. There's people there do not know if they're going to have a job in a couple of months' time. And the Ineos takeover is good, but it's also leading to doubts. It's leading to uncertainty. You've got staff members are going, wait a minute, why aren't I going to the cup final? The Glazers honoured this. What's going on here? And I speak to multiple people who work at the club, and the mood is just really, really flat. And people were telling me things like, Burnley will have more possession and dominate against us ahead of the game. And I'm thinking, what? And this actually happened. Sheffield United will scare us tonight. And this happened. I'm not even going to tell you what people are thinking about going into the game at Palace away. But all the fears came true. And then look beyond this. Arsenal, gulp. Newcastle United. I was saying last week, that looks like it's going to be a huge game. That's even if Manchester United are still at the races. For what? A Europa Conference League? Is that what we've come to? That, again, affects the mood adversely. This isn't, can we just get that Champions League place? Europa Conference League. And then the FA Cup final. We're supposed to be excited about a cup finals. People are just full of dread. At least Brighton aren't in form.
Well, they've just found form, haven't they? With that win over Aston Villa, just in the nick of time.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I mean, Laurie, the argument that's being made I've seen multiple people, match-going fans online, Manchester United fans, wherever they are, making the argument the team needs a new direction now. You know, there's three games left of the season to rescue European football. There's a cup final against Manchester City to prepare for as well. Again, I watched the Premier League's output tonight. Michael Owen, Erik ten Hag simply cannot be the Manchester United manager next season. And even Paul Scholes sat next to him was suggesting that that result and performance tonight felt like the end for Erik ten Hag. Is there an argument to change now? Where would you stand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've got friends that have suggested that. I personally don't agree with that, just because I feel like, what are you doing in that situation then? You've then got a kind of caretaker for three games. It's like a Ryan Mason situation at Tottenham. You know, Jose got sacked, didn't he, before a cup final. I just didn't...
One game before, yeah, wasn't it? Or one day before.
I just don't think that's the right thing to do. I think you give respect to the manager that's in position, who last season overachieved with what he'd inherited. So you do have to still remember that and don't disrespect the guy who's got to another FA Cup final, you know, from that incredible match against Liverpool. Let's not forget that was one of the best experiences I, you know, have been to as a fan. So I think you give the guy who got you there the credit to actually walk the team out as well. And then obviously you might have a conversation in the summer, because that, like I say, that performance, I can see where Paul Scholes is coming from there. It felt like an unravelling, you know, where you've got players doing their own thing and the manager seemingly unable to alter things. Now, as Andy's alluded to, the wider context, though, is the situation that Erik ten Hag is managing in. You can't ignore the dereliction of duty that's been happening for seasons, you know, the recruitment, the care that hasn't been there from the top of the club all the way down, the quality personnel around a manager that are able to execute and pinpoint ways of getting really good players into the squad, enhancing the players that are already there. So I feel like that's the context that Ineos are looking at. And, you know, we've been in this situation before, haven't we, where players maybe, you know, not liked what a manager's doing. There's been unrest. There's been the mood in camp is bad. Manager gets sacked, new manager, bit of a bounce, and then it happens again. So are Ineos, you know, is there an argument to make to say whatever happens, Ten Hag should actually stay, because then it gives the manager some authority, you know, at least.
The counter to the recruitment point, though, Laurie, is the fact that seven of the players on the pitch tonight, he signed.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
There was a moment in the second half where Anthony got onto the ball and got past halfway and he tried to thread a through ball into the final third for Garnacho, and he just missed the target. But rather than go, I messed up, let me correct this, he just berated Garnacho for some sort of perceived slight. And it's just so hard to stomach.
And that's on Ten Hag, isn't it? Because that's he's a player that Ten Hag pushed for. Now, you do go back to that summer, and basically Ten Hag wanted a striker the whole summer, never came, and then it got to the point where he just wanted some attacker, and he knew that he could trust Anthony to do what he wanted on the pitch. So that's why he pushed for him, and then, you know, the transfer fee is the transfer fee because United left it so late. But nevertheless, he is the player that Ten Hag pushed for, and I have serious reservations about, you know, the guy's character. I mean, we saw at the end when he's coming off the pitch, and again, you know, Jamie Carragher made a point of this, didn't he? Sort of whispering behind his hand with Mason Mount, and it just doesn't look right to me, that kind of thing. I don't want players whispering after a result like that on the pitch, you know. But whatever. So that is a Ten Hag signing. But I will say that there is just the whole point of Ten Hag, and yeah, he's a guy that wants authority at a club. So you can sort of say, well, okay, you've got this authority, now what have you actually done with it? But I would also say that he felt that he had to seize that authority, because what he was getting from, you know, the people around the place was not good, was not like, we have a plan here, we've got all these players that we're going to sign for you, this is why we're going to sign them, they fit your profile. So he's thinking, I better get active here. He was the one behind signing Wout Weghorst, for example, you know, on loan, because United had got into a situation where they had to scramble around your mate, and Ten Hag used his contacts to get a player in that actually did okay, you know. So it's not like he's been blessed with this incredible team around him that are producing players, and he's then picking them. And but I take your point that you can't then totally absolve him of blame or scrutiny for the recruitment that's taken place, because he has had involvement in it.
Yeah, that's the counter argument, basically, isn't it?
This season is a story of square pegs in round holes, And now the question is Ten Hag himself a square peg in the round hole of Manchester United manager? So the thing you've described there of going to get his own contacts to get Bart Feghouz, he's made himself a de facto director of football, because the situation of recruitment and director of football at Manchester United last season or in previous seasons has not been up to standard of a club of Manchester United's perceived stature and goals. And we spoke about this when Murta departed, about how he doesn't necessarily have the phone book compared to other well-known directors of football. And he's had to be on the back foot for certain things. And yeah, okay, then Ten Hag goes, all right, well, I'll sort this out myself. But also, Ten Hag's taste and Ten Hag's ability to measure the suitability for Premier League football now has a diminishing hit rate. And what did you make of Amrabat's second half substitution, for example?
I think he's a brilliant player. Thought he didn't deserve the yellow card, and hopefully he'll sign again next season. Sorry. And when you were talking about Anthony then, honestly, right, I didn't realise he was playing until he had a shot after 50 minutes. And if the manager doesn't want to talk about individuals, I think we should talk about some of them.
That was United's first shot on target, Andy. Give him some praise.
Honestly, I honestly thought, right, okay, yeah. I did know he was playing because, you know, you make a note of the lineup at the start. It hasn't worked out for Amrabat, and it hasn't worked out for a lot of the players. And yeah, we talk about the injuries, the 12 different injuries, but it's just so confused. I'm actually with Laurie. I wouldn't sack him. It's not my decision to make. I'm torn on it. I feel that, does he deserve to work in a new structure?
Sorry, I am getting kicked out of Sellers right now. But before I go, I just want to know, and I'll get back to this one, listen back to this. When you say Ten Hag sack, do you mean right now or do you mean just in general?
Right, okay. While Andy answers that, Carl, we'll say goodbye to you. But thank you for hanging on as long as the security guards would let you at Selhurst Park. Andy?
I mean right now, because I'm sure we're going to see a flood of stories saying he's got to go. And I get the point that new managers come in and you have a bounce with that. But I think what Laurie said is quite mature. He's the man who's got United to the cup final. There are strong mitigating circumstances. I know there'll be people listening to this who are absolutely fuming. They've lost confidence in the manager, and they're absolutely entitled to their opinions as well. I'm not making the decision on him. And part of me would like to see him work under this new structure. But people have this idealised image of what the new structure is going to be. Oh, it's fine, thankfully.
Yeah.
Thankfully, yeah. New people are coming in. They're going to face the same problems. They're only human as well.
Well, this is another factor, and I think I've mentioned this on a previous podcast, but this is another factor in the Ten Hag debate, in that if Ineos do, you know, sack him in the summer or get the new guy in, then it's straight on them, isn't it? You know, if the new guy doesn't, you know, start
definitely
blisteringly, then questions will start to arise with them.
Especially if it's likely to be a difficult summer with the way that the finances are.
I think it will be.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tien. I think finances, as you say, but also the personnel that Andy's, you know, suggesting. Jason Wilcox was academy director at Man City, and then he was sporting director at Southampton for a year. So this is new to him too. To be a technical director of Manchester United, it's a big jump. And Dan Ashworth, you know, when's he going to start? We don't know. I think Dan Sheldon wrote it might even be after the summer now. You've got Omar Berada as chief executive, again, a new role. These are exciting appointments, and definitely it's something that Ineos had to address. But it's not like you're coming in with ready-made, you know, sporting directors who've made deals happen at this level before. So I do feel like there's got to be some caution about the summer as well.
Okay, well, it's a shame that Carl had to go, because this is the point now where we talk about some of the specifics of the game, which he was at. But anyway, that's what happens when you're trying to get podcasts recorded and out as soon as possible for people. Obviously, we all watched it and probably had a similar view to all you guys listening as well. The biggest issue in that game, the glaring issue, Andy, has been Casemiro's performance. That's been the one major topic. There are plenty more, and we will talk about them. What did you make of his performance tonight, and what on earth was wrong with him?
I don't think he played well, and that's a massive understatement. He's had an awful season. I asked the manager a couple of weeks ago, and he put it onto his injuries. It's baffling. It's really sad. Someone who was one of the best players in the world in his position. And then he misses a ball and the huge gap is then left and Olise goes through and Crystal Palace are 1-0 ahead and they don't look back. He looked well to advance and I know other players were out of position as well. He was actually the one who put the ball in the net. Although Højlund did too.
Twice.
Yeah.
Then he lost the ball to Munoz as well, didn't he, before Palace's fourth. So he had an awful game. He had an absolutely terrible game. And I'm sure he'll be hurting deeply like the fans are as well. The fans aren't getting the same remuneration as him. But I keep coming back to this thing. What happened at the end of last season? Is it just a switch would go, your legs have gone dink?
There can't be.
It can't be, can it?
There can't be. No, it goes into the style, doesn't it? That has been another criticism as well. I mean, Carl was mentioning about Amrabat earlier, Laurie. You know, the question that came to my head was, could he not have lined up in that midfield instead of maybe Christian Eriksen just to try and beef it up a little bit more, considering that we had Casemiro and Johnny Evans just coming back from injury at 36 at centre-half. I mean, that's the 14th different centre-back pairing for Manchester United in just the Premier League this season. 28 different back fours now in all competitions. Obviously, there's been problem after problem, but surely they need a bit more protection, don't they?
I mean, I suppose who would you take out then? So you say Amrabat over Eriksen is what you're saying, or just put him in as a third with all, you know, with Maino as well.
Well, my argument would be to play him in front of the defence. Yeah, and I guess the obvious player to take out would be Eriksen. I'm no tactician, to be honest, but it just feels like that's a defensive midfielder.
Yeah,
and there weren't any in that Manchester United lineup really. I mean, you can make a case that Maino has got defensive qualities, but I don't think that's his strongest position from what I've seen so far. Anyway,
I sort of did this on the voice note, didn't I? I can't remember where I was in Vietnam, but after the Burnley game, where you know Casemiro was getting into midfield. Or was it Sheffield United, actually, getting into midfield quite frequently. And he did it again tonight. So I'm almost like, is he thinking that he needs to be in that position to protect, you know, to try and stop at source these things that are happening?
Yeah, potentially.
So that's what he obviously was. He's diving in there. You could make a compilation of Casemiro diving in this season badly. He was doing it last season, wasn't he, and kind of getting booked and things. But
he was dribbled past eight times tonight. That's the most any player has been dribbled past in the Premier League this season in a single game.
It's because he commits. You know, he commits to these things because it almost is like, has he got the energy to follow these players back?
But he's hugely experienced. Hugely experienced.
Yeah.
And he was so good for the majority of last season as well. So
And he played more games last season than he had done at any point in his career, you know, for Real Madrid. I wonder, is it that something happened over the summer where is he feeling disaffected by the fact that he thought he was coming to win Champions Leagues and titles and get United, you know, make United great again, and the signings didn't exactly echo that, and then also at the same time, you know, the fitness issues have started to creep into his career for the first time. And therefore he's not quite at the level that he thinks he should be at, and there's that kind of realization that you're not at that level anymore, and you sort of try and do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do to make up for that. It's a sad sight to see, because I think again for the second goal as well, for Mateta's goal, he's high again. So it's then Evans is the last defender who doesn't do well at all when Mateta just easily glides past him. But it's that kind of fragmented back line that is why this is a real... It's needs must, isn't it, at this point of the season? But I wonder, is that what's happening with Casemiro? There's a kind of psychological attempt to compensate for this kind of physical failing.
He kept pushing up against Coventry City, making those short passes to try and split the midfield, which is fine when you're going forward. But what happened when Coventry City counter-attacked? What happened later on in the game when his energy levels were dipping? It looked like he was pulling a large RAF issue parachute. And it was awful to watch it. And then he held his nerve in the penalties. What happened last summer? Did he just think, right, I'm going to relax now and enjoy Manchester? And think, oh, I didn't realise there was a curry mile, eh? I'm going to hit some of these restaurants. Chinatown.
Have you seen him in Rusholme, have you?
Well, Chinatown, no one's ever told me about this. I mean, you know what, I'm going to try four of these restaurants tonight. And then he's just obviously... Brazilian restaurants in Manchester. They didn't tell me this 20 years ago. There's three or four of them. I'm being facetious. It's just really sad because he is
And he's a great guy. Like you can see that he feels it. And around the place,
well, remember the story.
Younger players.
He sat at home watching Brentford messaging in, you know, tell him I'll sort it out, you know.
And he did.
And he did.
I know, yeah. I know. And that's what makes it even sadder. The other thing is, he's only 32. You know, we're not talking about a 38-year-old or something like that, are we? I mean, how old Thiago Silva is, Brazilian teammate at Chelsea? He's probably nearly 10 years older than him. I know it's a different position and whatever else, different players, but I suppose he wouldn't be the first at 32. He looks like he's lost a little bit of his physical attributes. But yeah, the start of being dribbled past more times tonight than any other player this season in a Premier League game was startling. I mean, two of them cost Manchester United goals as well.
And also for the free kick as well, Mitchell, he's not quite close enough to him, is he, to stop that happening. So really, he was involved in all four concessions, which again, you kind of want to give him a bit of, cut him a bit of slack because he's playing in this alien position. But then you did have, you know, Fernandinho used to drop back into central defence for City, didn't he? And he's in more cohesive team there, so it's an easier thing to do, I suppose. But you know, we've seen it before when midfielders have gone back and done pretty well. But there is a bigger issue though, isn't there? Because he's on big wages, you know, $350,000, something like that. And I know it gets cut because they're not in Champions League next season by, you know, sort of 20-25%. But it is, you know, one of, if not the highest earner at Manchester United, with two more years left on his contract. So that is something that they're going to have a serious look at.
Just on that, Laurie, obviously we know about the 25% drop if they're not in the Champions League. If they weren't in Europe at all, is there a further drop do we know about?
I don't know. I mean, it's always just been Champions League, and it was always that, you know, individual agents could actually negotiate for their clients sort of better rates, although I think it became basically a pretty set. You know, even Cristiano Ronaldo had a 25% cut in his salary, for example. So it's a serious thing. And when Casemiro joined, you know, there was this big talk about he's come for the money. Well, actually, his salary wasn't, you know, it was a little bit more than he was on at Real Madrid, but it was the length of the contract that appealed to him also. And then if he gets this cut, then it you know, drops back down to a level below what he was on at Real Madrid. So these are all kind of discussions that go in, but I don't know if they're out of Europe entirely. That is an interesting conversation to have. I would be surprised if they did have that. I think it's basically geared around the Champions League, but it's definitely one to have a look into.
I don't think they do, but there's natural win bonuses. There's performance remuneration when you play. And Manchester United make money out of playing football matches because Old Trafford is full and the Megastore is full. So even if it's the Conference League, the probability is that there's going to be 70,000 crowds. But as I say this, the probability of getting into that competition looks less and less each time. So we've gone from like Champions League to Europa League to Conference League. And I just wonder in the minds of the players, do they think that's worth playing for? Is that a factor?
Yeah, I think it is.
Well, they don't want to be in the Conference League.
They're clearly not massively motivated. I don't know.
It just seemed, I think that's kind of my point about the injuries almost as well. Like it just feels like is there that real deep drive there to try and get into the Champions League or whatever? It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, maybe we'll see it for the cup final. That would be interesting if, you know, you kind of have this surge towards that as a kind of end point. But it must be hard mentally to get yourself up for a game like that. I mean, Palace, you knew they were going to be, you know, difficult to play against. Glasner's got them playing some really good stuff, but
should it be hard though, Laurie?
It shouldn't be, should it? But I feel like if you've got all these issues around the club where you've got staff feeling uncertain about their own positions, you've got a manager that clearly, you know, people are talking about. And by the way, I didn't actually get into this, but, you know, Ten Hag might have his own options in the summer as well, by the way. You know, Bayern Munich is a legitimate option as a possibility, depending on kind of how things shake down in the next few weeks. But kind of keep an eye on that one perhaps. But I feel it's probably easy for us to look from the outside and say you should be able to block all that out as a player. But I think it must, if United scored first tonight, maybe it's a different story where they've got something to fight for. But as soon as that first goal goes in, it feels like here we go again.
Yeah.
And do you make that 5-yard sprint that you should do, you know, to kind of close down a player? Is that a sort of subconscious thing that's happening?
I And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you ever spotted McDonald's hot, crispy fries right as they're being scooped into the carton? And time just stands still. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Yeah, let's talk about the league position then, Andy. I mean, Arsenal next, then Newcastle, then Brighton away on the final day. There's obviously the cup final against City to look forward to as well. But United now are eighth. You know, they're level on points with Chelsea, but they're 14 goals behind them now in goal difference. Minus three for Manchester United after 35 games played, which is so far below what we would normally expect. For Manchester United at this sort of stage of the season. 13 defeats, the most in Premier League history already, with still those three matches to go. Obviously, Newcastle to face, who are now in sixth place. But can you make a case for United finishing in a European spot in these remaining games?
Well, you can, but it looks increasingly unlikely. By the week, Chelsea have hit form. Newcastle destroyed a Burnley team who Manchester United failed to destroy at the weekend. Above them, Tottenham have lost four on the bounce, but that fifth place is not going to lead to Champions League football anymore. So I said 3 or 4 weeks ago, I'm starting to look behind, not in front, because I was worried. West Ham are a team below Manchester United. They're in even worse form, and David Moyes is going to leave there at the end of the season. So the stats that you read out, the minus three goal difference, the 13 league defeats, this is taking me back to 1990 when the FA Cup did actually save United's season, but it was Palace who United played against. Palace crop up so many times in the club's history, it's uncanny. This time it's Manchester City.
Well, people were talking about Franco Farrell going tonight, weren't they? That was the only time Manchester United have conceded four or more goals against Crystal Palace previously, a 5-0 defeat in 1972, correct. Is my memory correct? Yeah.
Yeah, and there's been a few other ones apart from then. You have like a 20-year chunk where Palace bob around the divisions, get absolutely battered by Manchester United. I actually rate the manager. I think he's done well. I know they won at Old Trafford under Roy Hodgson earlier on in the season, but they've got two or three players there who Manchester United will probably pay £70 million for, and then they'll probably get worse when they come to Old Trafford. But
loan them back. Yeah, that's happened
loan them back.
Right?
But I know there are some fans who think stay out the European competitions. I'm all for it. Even that Conference League, I see merit in going to Bulgaria or Kazakhstan. I got pulled up on a recent podcast because I said Uzbekistan, and a pilot who's good at geography went, Uzbekistan's in Asia. And obviously he's right. And I was going to hit back and say, well, Kazakhstan's 80% in Asia, mate, but they're still in it. But I thought we're just going to get into a glue pot of arguing about where UEFA are drawing the rules there. But yeah, watching United away in Liechtenstein or even Nice.
Or Wales.
Yeah. Bring it on. At the moment, I don't think it's likely that Manchester United are going to be playing European football next season. That absolutely guts me.
Definitely. I mean, one of the other stats you mentioned about the stats, 81 goals conceded in all competitions this season, the most in a single campaign since 1976-77, and there's still four games of this season left as well for that record potentially to get worse. I mean, okay, we've talked about the manager, we've talked about the performance tonight, but we'll talk more about the sort of immediate future on Thursday's podcast. But Laurie, what can be done differently against Arsenal at the weekend to ensure that it's nothing like tonight?
I just worry if you can't change that defence, that central defensive situation, that, I mean, Arsenal will just absolutely tear them apart. You know, I saw them against Bournemouth, the highlights anyway, and, you know, a team that, again, caused United real problems, deserved to win down there on the south coast. But Arsenal were pretty composed against them, and you can see how they would... I'm not really answering your question here, am I? And you're sort of saying, how can things get better? Sort of just pouring.
Well, if nothing changes, will anything change? That's the. No, I mean, and I'm not arguing there that Erik ten Hag should be sacked now or anything like that. I'm talking about what can be done now to ensure that the next game isn't like the last one.
Well, I mean, if Bruno Fernandes is fit, then I do think that elevates what United can do. You know, I'm trying to think of the ways that you could. I mean, Harry Maguire, it's difficult to say without getting players back, really. But because with the players that he had at his disposal, I mean, yeah, as you say, Amrabat maybe is the only other one that you could have said, you know, Ahmad, could you start? Well,
they're about the only two senior outfield players on the bench.
Well, that's
tonight,
it. The bench looked like a crash, didn't it? Like, you had all these boys on the bench, and I felt, in a way, it's sort of good, you know, they're there, seeing it firsthand, seeing the kind of...
Wouldn't have been the most positive experience, so I don't suppose, but
well, that's it. I'm looking at their faces. They're just like, what do I think of this? You could see it etched on their faces, you know, this kind of wow, sort of, you know, shock on their faces. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose if they got anything from the game, it's just what not to do. But yeah, I don't know really how much you can change it, and which is, I suppose, you just hope that the players return with some semblance of commitment and doing the jobs, because clearly tonight they just, you know, it unravelled and they weren't doing their jobs, and that can't happen against Arsenal because it will be even worse.
I wonder if they'll be galvanised by the end of that game, Andy, because the one prevailing image in my head from that match was the scenes at full time when the players went over to the away fans. They were absolutely incredible all night. There was expletives galore coming across on the Atmos from the game. I'm surprised that the commentators didn't have to apologise, because they seem to have to do that these days. They were so loud all the way through, whether the scoreline was 0-0 or 4-0. They were loud at the end of the game. They applauded. I don't know if they did applaud the players, but they were certainly singing about the club, and the players were applauding them. Looked pretty embarrassed, to be honest. No, Erik ten Hag had gone straight down the tunnel, but I wonder if that moment does give them a little bit of something moving forward. I'm clutching at straws maybe a little bit.
I don't see Old Trafford being a bear pit on Sunday. I just don't think there's a mood for it at the moment. And
no,
Arsenal were brilliant at Old Trafford last season, but lost 3-1. That was a cracking game. And Laurie's right. If a couple more players come back, that will make a difference. But Marcus Rashford scored 2 last season. Anthony scored. These are not players who've had a good season this year. However, I'm going to give you a little bit of hope.
Oh.
United did beat Arsenal in New Jersey last July, quite comfortably, 2-0. And then the game went to penalties for no reason whatsoever. United won on penalties as well. That was when Mason Mount outshone Declan Rice. Jadon Sancho, remember him, playing as a false nine up front. And I watched that game and thought, okay, Manchester United, you know, second this season maybe. How wrong was I? I think they need to win the league. Part of United fans want them to win the league because it'll mean Manchester City don't win the league. When does City play before United at the weekend?
Yes.
If City were to drop points, which doesn't look likely, you're almost getting United fans wanting Arsenal to win because they don't want City to win the league. How on earth have our lives come to this? But they have done, and it's pretty depressing.
What was that at the end, in your opinion, Andy, from the away fans? Because there seems to be a little bit of confusion from what I've heard people say, you know, on TV and also online. What do you think that was?
Defiance. You can't predict when it happens. I'll give you another example when it did. A 4-0 at Anfield in September 1990. The team had been battered. Liverpool were brilliant. And that United end did not stop singing for 90 minutes. And it just happens rarely. And it's wonderful when it does happen, because it shows that it's not just about the glory that fans are going to get behind the team, and it's just really difficult to predict him when it's going to happen, because you can sort of say everyone get up for Arsenal, let's really get behind the team, but often it's chicken and egg, you need to be entertained. But if you're going to get it, it's going to be from the away fans. Just bizarre games, Middlesbrough in 92, one of the best atmospheres ever in the Stretford End. Why? Well, it was a semi, I suppose, but it's been pretty flat.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, it's a good reason. You know, United in the semi at Coventry, it was flat Wembley. It wasn't very good. It just wasn't. Definitely. You know, we can praise fans when they do well and criticise when it's not good as well. So don't have any miracles.
A situation like that, Andy, is it because the result was kind of predicted, to be honest? I mean, maybe not 4-0, but people...
Bookies had Palace favourites. I didn't realise that until after the game.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. And then obviously the game, early goal, it's clear the way the game's going from, you know, early stages. And in your mind, you've got this long trip down to South London, and, you know, you're thinking, if the players aren't going to show that we're Manchester United,
fuck it,
at least
let's
we
enjoy
as fans,
ourselves anyway.
We're going to show. Yeah. Exactly. And that's it, and we're going to enjoy. But also, there is that defiance, there is that kind of... You might mock the players, you're not mocking us. And but it did feel quite productive watching it from afar, like in that you've got these players that are actually witnessing this and looking at these fans that are still saying, you know, we love this club, we're fighting for it. Surely that goes into you as a player and you think, I've got whatever I think about the club, the structure, the manager, I've got to do my job on the pitch. And there was a flick of it away at City when Bruno Fernandes was stood clapping them for a long time, just sort of looking at them and kind of taking it in. So, you know, I hope that has some kind of effect there on the players.
I think you're right. It's pride in yourself. It's pride that you support, that you've gone to the game, you've paid your hard earned, you get behind your team. It's not just about the glory. You follow the team through thick and thin. That's what proper football fans should do. And too many outsiders would go, it's easy, you're Man United, you win all the time. We certainly don't win all the time now. But even when this club were in the second division, they were still the best supported team in England. You know, for consistently... Even when Liverpool were winning everything, Manchester United, apart from two seasons in the late 80s, were still the best supported team. And I think fans wear that as a badge of honour. I think a lot of people were attracted to United in the 70s, not because they were the best team, but because the support was incredible. You take 10,000 to York or Oxford, and there was hooliganism as well, but a lot of fashions came with the fans as well. It's one reason why Manchester United have a support way outside of Manchester. And as Laurie says, what you're getting out of, it's not just the 90 minutes, is it? You've gone often with your mates, you've had a drink, you've had a sing-song. If you feel that you've created a good atmosphere, then you can come back and say, yeah, we got absolutely hammered, we're terrible, but we're still outside in Palace and ultras with drums and plastic flags or whatever they've got.
Anyway, right, let's draw a line under that then. It's nearly midnight and I think we all need our beds now. But thank you for keeping us company while we emptied our brains and articulated our thoughts and everything Manchester United at the moment. You can do the same. Remember, you can use our email account. So get in touch, devilspod@theathletic.com. Let us know how you're feeling at the moment and any comments or questions that you've got about anything we've talked about tonight, and obviously anything in preview to the Arsenal game at the weekend as well. Thank you to Carl, who got off earlier, getting chucked out of Sellers Park, for being with us. Andy and Laurie, thank you for being here too. Nice to have you back, Laurie. Not much of a suntan, by the way.
It must be the Zoom. I'm brown as anything, honestly.
Are you? Okay.
No, I'm pasty white still.
I was going to say, yeah, I saw that.
Some things never change.
Never mind. Thank you for your company, like I said before. We'll be back on Thursday to preview the Arsenal game and talk about whatever the situation is then. Take care. Bye-bye.